On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we invite longtime MLB first baseman Eric Hosmer to stroll with us down memory lane, revisiting some of the best and most memorable happenings from his big league career. We also chat about why the heck Alex Bregman is unemployed and theorize what a Patrick Mahomes baseball career might have looked like. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who believes that the real big game in New Orleans is Tulane Baseball's home opener on Friday, February 14th against the University of Omaha. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. Or is it Omaha University?
I believe it is technically Nebraska Omaha, but folks, baseball season has already been here. Let's begin before we get to our actual opener, which is talk about Alex Bregman. We have plenty to talk about on the show. We have a special guest. We have Eric Hosmer coming on. Had a great conversation with him, remembering some of his most exciting and, I guess, memorable at-bats matchups in his major league career. That was a great time. We're going to recap some signings later. And yes, Jake, I did my homework. Don't you worry. But before we get to Alex Bregman and all that stuff, Jake, let's talk about what everybody does when the Super Bowl ends. And in this case, a very stinky Super Bowl concluded. And all the baseball fans hopped on, and many of the baseball teams were quick to say that it's baseball season. When you see these words, what does it make you feel?
I don't want to ever yuck a yum, but this sucks. Now, if you're a fan and you do this, I don't really have a problem with it, right? Because the energy behind it is all my friends have been talking about football for the last 3 months, and now that is over, and they will be talking about baseball again. That is a feeling I relate to, and I get that, right? But the idea that the team accounts and the league needs to organize and market itself in the shadow of football, which we all know is more popular. We've accepted that. That is a fact. But the idea that the final ticking seconds of the Super Bowl, that that is the starting gun for the MLB season, that is a farce. It is not real. And let's be real, baseball season doesn't really truly begin until we watch baseball games.
Yeah. Which, as you mentioned at the top, the Division I baseball season is indeed beginning officially this coming Friday. Division II, NAIA, Junior College, D3, that's already started. And one of the things that I always, you know, like to say is baseball season also never ends. Folks, the Winter League carried us all the way to Saturday.
Of course. Of course. Jordan,
but let's get back to your point. Let's get back to your point. Okay?
Go.
You're right. To me, it's like, it's not just that, like, oh, we have to think about us in relation to football. It's also like, no, we still have a long way to go to opening day. Yeah. I will not be watching Major League Baseball that I care about remotely anytime soon. And so when 21 of the 30 Major League teams have a tweet essentially ready to go within an hour of the last minute of the Super Bowl, do you want to guess the teams that didn't say football season?
the Phillies?
No. Oh, come on. Well, they're a little bit exempt. The Phillies and Cubs, I'm going to exempt because the Cubs pitchers and catchers reported yesterday. So they had a bunch of tweets going on Sunday, and the Phillies, the Eagles won. So it's like they kind of had their separate tweets.
I just would think that the Phillies were too busy congratulating Brandon Graham to say that it's baseball season, but I guess I'm wrong.
Teams that did not say some
the
variation
Yankees,
of
there's
baseball
no
season.
Chance the Yankees tweeted it's baseball season.
They did. They
no
absolutely
way.
Did. They had some teams. The Reds posted their entire hype video already. That I don't understand doing that in the middle of February. Teams that did not post: Angels, A's, Braves, Cardinals, D-backs, Guardians, Marlins, Rays, Royals, Tigers. Now, perhaps they will post this week. I'm sure they will. I mean, pitchers and catchers are reporting, and then you can do that, right? If you want to do it on the day, pitchers and catchers. But this is like within 2 minutes of the Super Bowl ending, 20 teams posted, we're up next. It's baseball season. Finally. Goodbye football. Things like that. And I agree with you.
I don't understand that because what's the audience for that, right? Like, the people who are thinking about the football game,
yeah.
It's not like the final play of the Super Bowl happens and then no one ever thinks about football again until September.
Well, that's
like,
true.
This
that's
true. Monday morning is literally all about like Jalen Hurts, like all anyone is thinking yeah. about.
Here,
also,
here's
just
my
quickly,
point.
Just quickly, for true pod listeners, for the hardos out there, know that I have been on the Jalen Hurts bandwagon for quite a long time. I will leave it at that.
I genuinely completely forgot about that, but I'm so glad you brought that up. Anyway, that's enough about that. So those are the teams that Jake, you think are focused on the right things. So congratulations.
Well, the Royals are the only team that had a real reason to do it, right? Because in Kansas City, if I'm a Kansas City sports fan, it's like, okay, now it's baseball season. I don't ever want to think about football again.
That's a great point. However, that would have felt a little too soon, right? Like, that probably would have come off in poor taste if the Royals, partially owned by Patrick Mahomes, were like, all right, well, that's over with. Vinny Pascantino.
Our part owner crapped the bed tonight, so it's baseball season. But when does baseball season begin? Oh,
baseball season doesn't start until you care about what's happening on the field. Until the a result meaningfully changes how you feel about the team from the fan perspective. Obviously, we have a slightly warped perspective as people who do this for a living, but I think that is still applies to us as well.
I think that is a great loose definition. And that can be player who was out of shape shows up looking ripped. That can be pitcher who threw 93 throws 96 in a game. Yeah. That can be third baseman blows their ACL out. Anything that you see in camp that meaningfully changes your understanding of your favorite team, I think, is when baseball season begins. Or it's when you see the third star in the sky. Or when the baseball groundhog pops out and does or does not see his shadow.
All kinds of options. Epic Havdalah reference, Jake. Let's move on now to our actual
email us.
First topic.
Email us.
Oh, yeah. When does baseball season actually begin? Because what we are putting forward is that it is not the second the Super Bowl ends. But maybe you disagree. BaseballBarbercast@gmail.com.
Can
Let
I?
Us know.
Is it maybe just opening day?
Interesting. Interesting suggestion. Perhaps Occam's razor is exactly the case here. Let us get to our opener. Jake Mintz, Alex Bregman, still unemployed.
Baseball season did not begin for him today.
No, and I think he would be on our, he'd be like, no, guys, baseball season has not started yet because I do not have a team. Alex Bregman is now all alone atop this free agent class without a team. Yes, I will continue to bang the drum for Nick Pivetta being undervalued, but listen, Alex Bregman is the one we got to talk about.
Baseball season does not truly begin until the last high-profile Scott Boras client signs a short-term deal with an opt-out.
I think that's a good answer. I think that's a good answer. Now, we dealt with Pete Alonso. He will report to Mets camp and all will be well there. That will feel the same as if it had happened in November. But Alex Bregman is now setting up, unless he signs in the next few days, he will be showing up to camp a little bit late somewhere. Will it be in Arizona? Will it be in Florida? He doesn't even necessarily know that yet.
And the worst part is if he shows up to camp late, he's going to have to run sprints as punishment.
That's
he's going to have to do poles. Everyone knows if you show up to practice late, the whole team has to run.
Maybe
so that's a downside. Whichever team signs Alex Bregman has to run as a punishment. Because
he's still
late.
Right. Maybe he can go play for LSU for the first couple of weeks. He's still got that year of eligibility. Hey, at this point, it's like, oh, what do you mean? He's been pro for years. He can't play NCAA now. I don't know. It's not now. Eligibility is a mindset at this point. Anyway, Alex Bregman, where are we at? Where are we at here? How did we get here? Where spring training is about to start. Now Alex Bregman is not a free agent, or is still a free agent. I don't know if we are have to recap, because I think the interesting thing with Bregman is that everything that's really happened with him, the most developments that have happened with him, have really just been the Astros roster and how the Astros have talked about him. The other teams that we have rumored to still be involved, whether that's the Tigers, whether that's the Red Sox, whether that's the Cubs, whether that's maybe the Blue Jays, although very much conflicting reports on how legitimate that is, that hasn't, we haven't really advanced much there. We haven't really gained too much understanding about that. Whereas the Astros part of this has developed in a lot of different directions over the course of the winter, where it seemed like they said he's our number one priority. And then they tried to trade for Nolan Arenado and he said no. And then they pivoted and now they bring in Paredes and Christian Walker. And then it's like, all right, well, that's it. We're done with Alex Bregman. And then a couple weeks ago, I was like, wait a minute. Altuve will move to left field. They want to bring back Bregman. And we still have reporting that they have this standing offer, this 6-year offer of, you know, $150, $160 million that's just still there for him to take to, I guess, play third base and, you know, move Paredes and Altuve and whatever. I just don't know. I just don't really know what to make of this. Like, we've tried to slam the door on the Astros and Bregman so many times. We had Dana Brown speaking to him in the past tense. But again, we just had that with Pete Alonso and the Mets. So it's like, I don't really know what to make of that. Again, I don't know where this is leaning because there's too many teams still involved in a way that with Pete, it was like, all right, dude, like there's just nobody else there's no fit here. Whereas now, because the Tigers are still such an obvious fit, because the Red Sox in some ways are still such a good fit, because even the Blue Jays, you could still say are a good fit. I'm struggling to lean in any direction the way with Pete, we just threw our hands up and said, well, he's going to be a Met.
I think I disagree because of the teams involved. So the Astros don't have an open spot, really, right? Moving Jose Altuve to left field is not an open spot. Two of these teams, the Red Sox and Cubs, have been embarrassingly frugal with their bank accounts over the last handful of years in free agency generally, right? And so I find it hard to believe that they're going to splurge and give Bregman what he wants. The Blue Jays and the Tigers, to some extent, have already spent a pretty significant amount of money in free agency. If you look at the Tigers' payroll year over year, it's climbed quite a bit. And then the Blue Jays are running the fifth highest payroll in the sport. There are reasons to look at each team and not believe that they're going to pay Alex Bregman. And I think this entire scenario shows the downside and the risks of trying to wait out the market, right? And there will be a team that bites and signs Alex Bregman because the number will dwindle low enough for their liking where it's like they have an appetite to spend an amount on Alex Bregman, right? But that number is not going to be what he wants. Like, I find it incredibly hard to believe that Bregman is going to feel satisfied with the result of his offseason now. Because that number would have already been signed and agreed and, you know, he'd be holding up a jersey somewhere. But that's not the case. And it is the downside of the Scott Boras, let's just wait this thing out strategy, in my mind.
I don't know. I'm not quite at the point where I think he's doomed to a one-year deal yet. I think that
because... Oh, I don't think so either. But if he wanted $200 million, the only... That's not happening in this timeline that we're living in.
It does not seem that way. It does not seem that way because I don't know what would have to change now for one of these teams to get desperate because, you know, with the pitching, it's very likely that this week teams will report and there will be pitchers that either will get injured soon or have been injured over the offseason. We'll find out about that. It's a little bit harder to do that with the position players, but the more important part is kind of the thing you said about Detroit and Toronto. Most of the teams have just spent their money. Like they had their budgets and like they have already kind of outlaid stuff. That doesn't mean that Alex Bregman's going to only get $5 million. It just means that it's a lot less likely that someone is going to spend this much this late in the process. If we compare this to Matt Chapman, you know, a year ago, Chapman stretched all the way into, I believe it was like March 3rd that he ended up signing. So that's pretty significant. By the way, there's a lot of parallels there. That's not just that he's another Boras, you know, position player for agent. I mean, that's another third baseman who, you know, was known for his defense, was coming off not his best season, but still had a very long track record of 3 to 4 to 5 war production. Bregman carries a lot of other things that I think probably makes him feel like he is much more deserving of a massive contract than maybe Chapman was willing to accept because he's Alex Bregman. He's the guy that's been in the postseason every single year. He's won World Series. He won in college. He's never not won. Alex Bregman has never been a part of a losing team. That's not really his MO. And so he just has a lot more cachet than I think Chapman does, even if the overall production was probably pretty similar and the age was similar and everything was similar. And maybe some of the concerns were similar. Although, of course, with Chapman, it was different because he was striking out, right? Bregman, when you're projecting forward with Bregman and you're saying, why don't you want to pay him a lot of money? It's because you think, well, he's a small dude and there's no way he's going to be like slugging to a legitimately impressive degree when by the time he's 35, let alone how good is the defense going to be at that point. Chapman is a little bit of a different profile. But I guess my point is, with Chapman, I also remember there were fewer teams even reportedly involved. And so then it was like, all right, well, now he ends up on the Giants. My intro to this, comparing it to Pete, brings me to ask you this, as we kind of wrap this conversation up, because again, we just don't have that much more information. If you are leaning somewhere, where do you think this is going to go? Because the longer the Cubs stick around in this, I'm really intrigued there, but yeah, the Cubs and Red Sox are both interesting. They're both just refusing to do it. They both are also parallels for a lot of reasons. Their biggest moves have been trades, right? Aggressive trades that they have not actually increased their payroll much, if at all, even though the Red Sox have spent more money in free agency than the Cubs have. I don't know. Are you leaning in any sort of direction here?
The Red Sox are the team that has the least excuse. He makes them better. He gives them a important, meaningful veteran presence, a bankable player in a team that does not necessarily have a lot of those guys. He's a right-handed bat in a lineup that is very left-handed heavy. And if he's willing to go play second base for Boston, to me, that's a no-brainer. And the only thing that is stopping them is their desire to keep the payroll down. Now, the payroll right now for them is at 171. Which is nothing for Boston. But, and so, go ahead.
Well, the thing about Boston that's been reported that's so interesting is that, I mean, clearly what Bregman's asking for financially has to be a part of it. But it also seems like there's some tension between the ownership of the front office, where it's not just the payroll. It's also that Breslow believes, well, I got three superstar players that are ready to go in the big leagues right now, and Christian Campbell and Marcelo Meyer and Roman Anthony. And like, those are our big guys.
But that's not real. With all due respect to top prospects, they're not real.
Are you saying that's not real because you don't believe that that's what Breslow feels, or because you
disagree? No, I believe that's what Breslow feels, and okay, I think he's wrong.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm with you on that. Yeah.
One of your players will get hurt, and there will be a lane for the good prospects that you have. That happens almost every time.
Or one of your
time.
Prospects actually isn't that good.
Exactly. Well, that's really what I'm saying, is that banking, if you're the Boston Red Sox, your plan cannot be, well, I hope these prospects are good. Like, that's what the Rays do, okay? That's how the Rays operate. That's how the Brewers operate. That's how the Guardians operate. When you're the Red Sox, the point of being the Red Sox is that you don't need to live life that way. And so I find that to be somewhat unfortunate, where he just fits into this team such an obvious way. He was with Alex Cora in Houston. They have a good relationship. Cora clearly wants Bregman around. Now, do I think that is eventually going to happen? No. I think in the end, he goes back to Houston because they're the team I think that's willing to pay the most for him, because he means more to that team than he does to other teams, right? And so if you're the Red Sox and you put a number value on what you are willing to pay for Bregman, that number has to be lower than whatever the Houston number is. And that is because of the emotional attachment in part, and because he has more economic value within the city, right? For bringing fans to the ballpark. This offseason that Houston has had has been such a kind of gut punch for the fan base, because it looks like they're taking a step back. When you trade someone like Kyle Tucker, that it's impossible as a fan to not read that as, we are not trying as hard. If they bring back Bregman, it rejuvenates the fan base in a very meaningful way. Not like this fan base hasn't seen a lot of winning, okay? But these dynamics are at play. They are real. So I think in the end, he ends up back in Houston just because he means more to that team than any of the others. And it's similar. It's what the case was with Pete, right?
Yeah, with much less obvious, a lot more positional finagling. But I think that's valid, although At this point, I think it would have happened by now. I don't know. I guess maybe he just thinks that it's the longer he waits that, yes, you can convince Jim Crane to pick up the phone and increase the offer because that's the kind of owner that he is. I don't know. I think he's going somewhere else. I'm leaning towards Boston still somehow, that they find a way to make it work. And then Detroit and Chicago are interesting. Detroit is an obvious fun combination that we've kind of pointed out. That would need to be the long term. It's not going to make sense for him to go to Detroit for 1 or 2 years. I can see Boston ending up being the team that gives him the short year, you know, the short contract. That's a place where you can imagine he would enjoy hitting for a shorter period and then maybe re-entering the market. Other than that, and then Toronto, I don't know. I feel like they've kind of tapped out, and they also have to be in extend Vlad Jr. mode. I can't imagine that they can still be prioritizing Bregman at this point.
I don't think Bregman's taking a short-term deal. This is a dude who wears number two because he was the number two pick in the draft,
yeah,
right? I just don't think he is wired in a way where he's going to be willing to swallow pride. Like, I think he is not interested in that. And that's part of why we're still here, if that makes sense. Yeah. All right, enough. Enough on Alex Bregman.
Okay.
I'm bored of him. Let's talk about a real winner. Just kidding. Eric Hosmer.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Hosmer joined the show. We interviewed him last week. It was an absolute delight. Oz rules. I love any human being who is never referred to ever by anyone by their first name.
Yes.
No one calls him Eric, as he admitted to us. He said his mom calls him Oz.
Which is so funny. But yeah, so we had Eric Hosmer on for this is not, we're not going to talk to Eric Hosmer about free agency or anything. This is not getting his take on the game, although you can hear that because he has his own podcast, Digging Deep Podcast. Check it out. As far as baseball player podcast goes, we think it's one of the better ones. But we wanted to kind of do a little stroll down memory lane and have him remember some highlights and, I guess, lowlights of his career in a very entertaining way. So I won't say anything more than that, but hopefully you enjoy this conversation with a very, very, very good Major League Baseball player, Eric Hosmer. We'll be right back here on Baseball Barbecue.
Overjoyed to be joined by four-time Gold Glover, World Series champion, king of Kansas City, Missouri, Mr. Eric Hosmer. Hello, sir.
I love the king, dude. King Hos. I might have to start using that. I appreciate that.
When you return to Kansas City, do you have beverages purchased for you? Because people always say, like, oh, he never needs to buy a drink in that town again. Like, does that actually happen to you, or is that more of a saying?
It does happen, but at this point, I mean, I'm fighting to break back even. I don't know if you guys heard the story, but in 15, yes, when we went out, or I'm sorry, 14, that was our first playoff time, I ended up going to a bar, got a little emotional, I was in the moment, bought round for the whole entire bar. So I'm still trying to fight back to the green, man. It's at least even.
I feel like probably worth it for the yes, time that you had. I don't think there are any regrets there. So, Mr. Hosmer, we really appreciate you joining us. What we're going to do here today is a little trip down memory lane, a little bit of a quiz, a little bit of a storytelling time. You had, obviously, a tremendous major league career with a lot of experiences that, you know, most baseball players could never dream of having.
Now, wait, before we continue, you're done, right? Don't come back?
Dude, I'm so good at podcasting. Why the fuck would I go back in that batter's box? Absolutely not, right? No, absolutely not.
You heard it here first on Baseball Barbercast. Put it on MLB Trade Rumors. Eric Hosmer not considering comeback. Clap it up for the career.
I was going to say.
Clap it up.
Hey,
clap
listen.
Up.
Listen,
put it on the ticker.
You got, I believe, what was it? Third in rookie of the year, you know, in the big leagues. As far as your rookie year as a podcaster, pretty close to, I mean, I don't know what the awards would be if they're, you know, rookie of the year in podcasting, but I have to feel like this was a pretty successful first season for you on the mic.
Listen, I feel good about where I'm at, but at the end of the day, man, the baseball season as a fan is a long season, dude. And I kind of understand the flow of it now, but man, it's a grind, dude. So I got respect for what you guys do, even if you guys are, I'm sure you guys, this is the Cespedes Barbecue crew. I'm sure you guys have thrown some stuff out there that I would see and I'm like, God, I hate these guys. But It's all right, love. And it's all respect. Dude,
well, Haas, also, it's amazing that you just said that, like, man, that's a long season as a baseball fan. That's coming from someone who's played actually 162.
Yes. So, yes, dude. So you, it is.
If anybody knows what a long season is, I would think it would be you. So I guess now you see it from a different perspective.
Got to fill the airwaves somehow. Okay, so let's begin here. All right.
Come on.
Who are the five pitchers that you faced the most often?
Five that I faced the most. So that's going to be Scherzer's got to be up there because I faced him in the Central and the West a lot.
Yep. It's number three. He's tied with somebody else.
Not tied with Verlander, but is Verlander in that top five? Verlander.
Number one.
Number one. Okay.
By a lot. See,
the AL Central, man, when I was coming up in Kansas City, dude, it was no joke. I mean, we were facing those guys in Detroit, Chicago. We faced Sale and those guys, but I don't know if Sale's on that. Sale's on the top five?
Sale's number six. Yeah, so not quite.
I mean, what a gauntlet of three of the top six guys to face most, right, in the big leagues? Jesus Christ.
Okay, here's the top. Here are the other guys for you. Okay, Verlander's one.
Okay.
He's not bad. I think he's going to be pretty good one day. Quintana 2, Quintana, Scherzer 3, yes. Kluber 4, Kyle Gibson 5. Any of those Gibson. Guys stand out in your mind as any like particular battles?
Yes, it's so funny, man. Quintana, Jose Quintana. So I told you that AL Central gauntlet. Like we had this screen in Kansas City and we'd go on road trips and it would tell you the next 7 days. So you would basically see like the city, the weather, and then the probable starting pitcher. And we would look at this board sometimes, Moose and I in our locker, and we're like, dude, we got Scherzer, Verlander, Sale, Quintana. Like, what the how are we going to survive? So, like, honestly, man, like, getting to Quintana, it's like, okay, we can breathe, man. Like, this guy's good, but he's accurate. He's over the top. I can kind of lock in. Sale's coming from behind my neck, all these guys. And, dude, I surprisingly have good numbers off of Sale, and I'm not going to lie. I was probably scared to death in the box. And Quintana owned me. And I was like, I'm so comfortable. I'm going to ground out to second base right now, but I'm so comfortable doing this. I don't understand how this is possible.
Right. You're like, hey. What would you rather have, an uncomfortable single or a comfortable rollover, you know?
Yeah, the uncomfortable single, dude. I got a career after baseball I got to worry about, like Roger Dorn, you know what I mean?
and Quintana, I'm so glad you mentioned it because, yes, as you correctly identify, you did – I mean, like 300 points of OPS better against Chris Sale than Jose Quintana. And that's both left-on-left matchups. As you mentioned, lefties, nightmares against Chris Sale still to this day. But let's also mention, Jose Quintana can still pitch too. I mean, that guy's still cooking also. And there has to be something about him that is working, even if you're not necessarily uncomfortable.
Yeah, he's been durable for a long time. He's been eating up quality innings for a lot of good teams, you know, but... Yeah, man, the Sale thing, I don't know. I have no answers for that because I was scared to death in there off that guy.
So, yeah, I'm fascinated by that because is there something to when you're in the box against a guy like Sale left on left where your level of intensity and focus gets ramped up a little bit in that type of at bat? Now, obviously, as a big leaguer, you're trying to bring your A game in every single time you step to the dish, but that it's a long season. You're taking 700 plate appearances. You can't actually do that. Is there something to when you're digging in against Sale that like your body like boots up to a different level?
Yeah, you definitely do, man. And the messed up thing about facing a guy like Sale is hitting now, you have to look for these tunnels because the ball's moving in so many different directions. So as a hitter, you want the ball to start in a certain tunnel. And if it starts there out of the hand, you feel like it's going to be a good spot. The fucked up thing with Sale is the ball's got to start pretty much at your head for his slider to be a hanging slider. And honestly, man, he's throwing 97, 98 with crazy movement. I was hunting that slider every single time. So it was tough because I want that thing to pop out of my head and I see the spin and I'm like, okay, it's a slider. But if it's a heater up and in, it's like, man, this might get me in the neck, you know?
But I do have to imagine because you saw him a lot, eventually you sort of started to pick it up and have way more success than you would think than the guy that maybe sees him, you know, once or twice every couple of years. Because if it's the first time, I have to imagine you're just like, well, what? I've never seen anything like this before.
Yeah, the first time. And he came up real early in his career out of the draft and was in the bullpen. So it was like, man, I don't want to face that guy. And then he goes in the starting rotation. And it was so funny because, you know, we played each other so many times. We faced each other so many times. He was like a guy that didn't really throw changeups to lefties. And then I got some hits, some homers off him, had some success. And he started busting out the changeup on me. And I hit a homer on one of his changeups. And I just remember him yelling as I hit it. And he's just like, what the f***, Kaz? Like, what do I throw you? And me and him just had this funny back and forth. And I'm like, dude, I have no idea what's happening.
That's a great sign of respect as a left-handed hitter. That you almost level up to receiving a left-on-left changeup. Because no lefty is going to get that first time in an at-bat against a left-handed thrower. Like, you're just never going to get that. So it is a point of pride, I imagine, to get a left-on-left changeup. So from Chris Sale, you mentioned Jose Quintana. Mm-hmm. What was it about Quintana you think that gave you fits?
Man, it was a nice, easy delivery. He had nice movement on his fastball, though. It was a good quality sinker. And it's one of those things, man, where like you think you're swinging to a certain spot and you go back and look on video and it's just a ball or a half ball away from that spot. So Quintana was so effortless that the ball kind of jumped out of his hand. So it's like, man, it's as the older you get in your career, you know essentially what pitches you're going to get and how the pitcher is going to attack you. So I knew Quintana was coming at me with sinkers. I knew it was comfortable, but I just couldn't get under it, man. I couldn't, you know, really get through it and under it the way I wanted to.
It really is. The numbers are striking, just like to compare it with Sale. So against Quintana, you were 17 for 80.
Ugh, okay. Man.
17 for 80. And against Sale, you were 18 for 52. Right. That's and so I cannot imagine there are many hitters who have those splits left on left against those two guys. It's just so interesting.
Man. I can't even explain it.
Before we, I do want to go. We'll get you feeling good here again with the other guys that you crushed. But is there anyone else that stands out that gave you particular fits? I mean, again, we have the numbers in front of us, but from off the top of your head, pitchers that you did face a lot, whether it was in the Central or even later in your career, that you had maybe guys that were Hall of Famers or guys that you wouldn't expect that you had trouble with.
Yeah, I would say towards the end of my career, and when I signed in San Diego and Walker Buehler started coming up, because really, the left on left thing we just talked about, there was really no righty that I'm like really kind of sweating facing stuff wise. I feel like you can see it all. It's just a matter of executing. And then Walker Buehler, those first couple of years, man, his stuff was filthy. And I remember we faced him one of the first times in a game in Mexico and they threw a combined no hitter. And I'm like, man, this guy's, he's got nasty stuff. But as a righty, that was the first time that's happened.
So like as a fan, this is the coolest thing. When the story and the memory just matches up with the numbers perfectly. Like Walker Buehler smoked you. Like absolutely kicked your ass. Right. And like because sometimes the players don't remember things correctly. And it happens, right? You play so many games, it all melds together. I mean, you were 6 for 28 against Walker Buehler with 7 punch outs. Like he just took you to school.
I don't know about melting. This is the Cespedes barbecue and you guys coming out. You can't, we just can't be too cool with each other.
How many hits do we have against Walker Buehler?
That's where that's coming. Nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm over
hey, man,
against Walker
Buehler. What Buehler did this postseason was unbelievable. Sick. Because that game, if you're watching as a hitter from the Mets, when he came out and just started spinning everything, throwing nasty sliders, then he went to the Yankees in the World Series that next game and was pumping 97. The way that he kind of game planned both those teams was unreal as a, like for me as a big league hitter looking at how he game planned, unbelievable.
And that's coming off of a season of struggles, right? I think that's what made Buehler's season so cool because what you're talking about when you were facing him, I mean, this is when he's first coming up and the stuff is before his second surgery was unbelievable. We only saw that in glimpses this past season, but obviously when it counted, you know, it looked like Walker Buehler all over again. So that definitely makes sense. Okay, so let's fire you up a little bit more here. Okay,
come on.
We mentioned Chris Sale. All right, let's talk about some other guys that you had a good amount of success against. You know, there's one player that you had 5 home runs against. So maybe that's a good place to start. And I don't believe anybody else that you had more than 3. So this certainly stands out. who do you think that pitcher is?
Was it Santana, Irvin Santana?
Yes.
It was Big Irv. Now, I will say,
magic.
Irvin had a hell of a career. He did give up a lot of home runs. So you mentioned, like, there's, of course, you were usually naturally going to be more comfortable against right-handed pitchers. Is that just a situation where it's like, all right, this guy, if I can get my A swing off, like, we're going to get this in the air? Obviously Irvin's one issue, because otherwise a hell of a career for him.
Oh, yeah, man. Great. And the only reason I knew that is because we played together. So I feel like we joked about it a lot of times. But I just feel like the way his pitch shape's move just kind of matched up with my bat path. You know what I mean? Like, I was always on his breaking balls. I faced him a lot when I was younger. When I was younger, it's completely different. Like, you're just hunting the heater all the time, trying to see the ball up, trying to really lay off breaking balls. And then you start facing guys more and more. And if you can't catch up to the heater, then it's like, maybe I'll look for a slider up, or you start to have more of a game plan and you seek out more pitches.
It's so interesting the way you say, like, the shapes matched. Because I don't know if a lot of fans think about pitcher-hitter matchups that way, where it's almost like certain flavors of food go well together. It's like the mechanics of your swing, something that you have some control over, but also you're just born with a certain type of movement, just fits right with a certain type of pitcher.
Yes, and I think that's now where hitting has gone. It's so much more advanced. When you see the horizontal movement and the, you know, the vertical ride a ball has, that's what it allows these hitters to do. It compares them, that stuff, it compares that pitch to a certain pitcher and his pitch. So, like, if I see Verlander's slider and I'm facing Santana for the first time and they metrically have that same number, it's like, okay, just think of Verlander's slider. That's what it's going to be. So that's really how advanced hitting has become. And guys take these numbers and then they prep for those numbers in the cage now. You should see some of the prep. These guys are putting, you know, the machines on 130 miles an hour and making it break like a slider. Like, the preparation's crazy now.
Well, that's what you got to do. And I'm sure the tools that they have now are even, as you mentioned, probably even more advanced than what you had, at least coming up. Maybe towards the end of your career, you had stuff closer to what they're using now. But yeah, like you said, there's only so much you can really replicate to prepare for some of these guys. So before we go to more of a rapid fire round, I do want to talk about some of the other guys we have mentioned. But just again, like those Hall of Famers, CC Sabathia just getting into the Hall of Fame. You face some other guys that, of course, will be in the Hall of Fame. We mentioned Verlander, we mentioned Scherzer, Kershaw, someone you saw a little bit. Any of those matchups stand out particularly over the years with the guys that, you know, the legends of the game?
Yeah, Kershaw, I had great numbers against Kershaw, man. I know that for a fact because we faced him in Kansas City. I did well first couple times, and then going to San Diego, I kind of kept it going. And then every hitters meeting, they're like, "Haas, you've had good success. What is it?" But it's funny, the first time we faced Kershaw, or second time, we were in LA. It was the day before the All-Star game, and it's 2016, 15 or 16, one of those years where, remember, the fans kind of flooded the voting and like six, seven guys on the Royals made
Omar
the
All-Star Infante, game. Baby. We'll never forget it. Infante. Of course. Yes.
Well, so literally everybody on our team is going to the All-Star game, but me, right? Like the whole starting lineup. So the day before travel day to go to the All-Star break, it's a day game. We're in LA. Get to the field, we got the lineup, and literally, I'm like the only guy in the lineup. All the All-Star guys are not in the lineup. They're like down, like, they're like hour before the game, packing their All-Star bags up, getting all their shit ready to go to the All-Star game, and I'm hot, dude. I'm walking around the clubhouse, I'm like, oh, is this scrub day? Is this what this is? We're just going to take this one off? I guess one game out of the playoffs, we're going to take this one off? And dude, I was so fired up that day. I ended up going 3 for 3. I got a homer the first at bat. I'm in the dugout. I'm like, you guys go pack your All-Star shit. Daddy will take care of this. You go pack your All-Star shit. I got this. And then I got a couple more hits, so I was just talking shit the whole game.
This is great. Okay, so July 9th, 2017, Dodgers 5, Royals 2. The Royals had 6 hits that day, and Haas had 3 of them.
Check okay? the lineup so you... out, dude. No offense to my boys. No offense.
No, no offense. They were all All-Stars. What are you talking about? All these other guys were off to the All-Star game. And by the way, that success against Kershaw continues all the way until 2020 postseason. Oh, yeah. You know, we're hitting. It's that was something that, and that's another matchup that you maybe wouldn't have necessarily expected. But the fact that you dominated Sale and Kershaw is quite the thing you can kind of flex on as a left-handed hitter in the big leagues at this time.
It's wild, man. You know what it is? Honestly, man, back to Jake's point about hitting, I think a lot of teams now match up with the right-left situation, but Kershaw and Sale both got, like, for me, anything coming into me, so like a righty cutter or a lefty sinker, that's what messed me up. I really had no chance at that. So I think platooning is now, instead of a left-right matchup, it's kind of the horizontal movement. So if there's a righty with a sinker or a lefty with a cutter, something going away from me, I think it's a way better matchup than that ball that comes in on my hands.
I also think a lot of lefties generally are trying to yank. Mm-hmm. And I think that your swing was more backside oriented, more inside out with pop than a lot of lefties today. Like, mm-hmm. in my mind, like a similar kind of path is like Josh Bell, right? Where the hands stay really close to the body the whole right. way through. And I imagine that allows you to kind of stay on a slider away from you from a left-handed pitcher yeah. in a way that, you know, a lot of lefties are just flailing at that thing.
Right, right. That was when I was my best. When I was, you know, through the ball, trying to go to left field with the heater. And then, man, this is bad, dude. I just keep seeing this pop up. And then try and pull the breaking ball out front. And then I think towards the end of my career where I got a little f***ed up was when I tried to get, you know, that like Ferris wheel swing action going and tried to pull the ball a lot more. And then that kind of took away from my ability to go to the opposite field, you know?
Here we go. I'm excited for this next question. Walk-offs. Yeah. How many Ooh. Walk-off hits did you have?
Fuck, oh, man. I know. I'm going to say 4.
See, this is why we love doing this.
Mr. Hosmer, you walked off 9 Major League Baseball
9.
Games.
I'm a beast, dude.
How many? Now, this I have a feeling, because 4, it seems 4, like we're zeroing in on the ones you remember.
Yeah.
I'm assuming there's one you remember the most, but maybe mm-hmm. I'm wrong. So, but why don't you share with our audience the one you remember the most?
I do. So it was a walk-off grand slam against the Rockies at home, and it was against Greg Holland, who was he was our closer for Kansas City, badass, whatever. So I was a guy, I never wore undershirt. So hit the home run, jumping on home plate, everyone's mobbing up and down. Somebody decides to just rip my jersey, dude. They just rip my jersey, start like dropping my pants, and I'm just like, what the hell's going on? So we're by the dugout, and Joel Goldberg, who I love, he's our sideline reporter. Yeah, he's like, hey, can I get you for the interview? And I'm like, Joel, like, I'm naked right now. So I just kind of run inside and go up to the clubhouse, and we're like hanging out, whatever. And Joel, like, to this day, like, made a huge deal about it. He's like, man, why'd you pass me up on the interview? He's like, I get it. You're such a good teammate. You just didn't want to show up Holland out there, right? That's why you didn't do it. I'm like, no, Joel, I was just fucking naked, dude. Like, that's why I ran in there. It's nothing to do with anything. But he literally, I just did like an interview with him a couple months ago, and he brought it up. And I'm like, Joel, just get over this one time, dude. But I just always remember that one for sure.
The only other walk-off note, and then we'll do some more rapid fire before we get out of here, is you had 2 walk-offs against Matt Thornton.
Really?
So early in your career, you managed to get Matt Thornton twice. That's another. You know,
those are probably the only 2 hits I have off of Matt Thornton, because I do. When you talk about memory, I do not remember much success off that guy.
No, well, there you go.
My favorite one on this list is a walk off single against Phil Koch to score Miguel Tejada, which just in my mind like doesn't make sense.
All right, Miguel Tejada, the Royals. Oh man, that's such a good one.
I know, right. Miguel Tejada was great too. That's what a random stat line that is.
a lot of names you would not expect in the same sentence. Okay, let's we're gonna go a little bit quick here. Okay, and then we're gonna end with something we're very excited about. Who is the pitcher that you faced the most without a single hit?
Faced the most. Pretty specific. Man. Without a single hit.
Single hit.
Got, I would hope it's some kind of some reliever, some fuck, I'm trying to think.
It is a lefty.
He's gonna be here. You go. Here's a hint. He will be on the Hall of Fame ballot for the first time next season.
Be on the Hall of Fame ballot first time next season. Lefty, reliever. Yep.
Nope.
It's not Phil Koch. not a reliever.
Not a reliever. Hall of Fame.
Very much Leary. Not a reliever. Like, this guy was a starter.
Liriano? Francisco Liriano?
No, that's
great
a good
guess.
I think you faced him way too much, though. I would faced have to imagine. Only 13 plate appearances.
The answer is Cole Hamels. 0 for 13 against Cole
Yeah,
Hamels.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Cole was the left-on-left changeup guy, and that just, I mean, I would swing right over that changeup every single time.
Let's go back to the Phil Koch's of the world. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Least favorite loogie to face. Least favorite, just lefty reliever. Like, oh God, here comes this guy. Oh no, like he's employed just to get me out. Basically, who are some of those guys that stand out? Because
there was you just got me flustered. There was a couple, dude.
There's
Rizchemski? Remember
Boom.
Mark Rizchemski?
Yes. Exactly. That was the first one we were going to say. Mark Zochinski.
Sinker from hell, dude. Jesus.
Yeah. 2 for 15.
Yeah, he was. Him.
That's I mean, that's the correct answer. We can move on from that.
You did it. Let's, 10 points to Gryffindor.
Yeah, I felt like certain teams just kept trading for him to get us out.
What is the only major league ballpark that you do not have a homer in?
Is it Philly?
Yes. Nicely done. Yeah, good
so
job.
Weird, right? I don't have a. Yeah, so, that's.
I mean, obviously, you know, you did spend most of your time in the American League, but you did have a good amount of time in the National League. Like, you played in all of these ballparks, and you did manage to homer in all of them except for Philly, which, again, I don't think you played there that often. But yeah, that's the one. How about that? So that makes me think that you were sort of keeping track of this over the course of your career. Is that?
Yeah, oh, I definitely was aware of it, dude. Because it's like a place where everyone goes and they're like, all right, I need to get one or two homers here before we leave. Right. I just could never get a homer there.
That's
I don't get
so
it.
Funny. That's yeah. so funny.
That's a good vacation. Just go for the weekend. We'll set the machine up. You go yard once, call it a day.
Dude, Philly, that happened. So when I was with the Padres coming out of the All-Star break, we had one workout before we opened up the second half. And the guys that were on the West Coast for the break did it at Petco. The guys that were on the East Coast, our hitting coach, Matt Stairs, he was holding the workout in Philly. So, dude, Matt Stairs was the best. He's literally like, dude, this. We're just going to take BP and just drink some beers. So we just brought a cooler of beers out and we're just all just grouping up into two different teams doing home run derby for like 2 hours at Citizens Bank there. And it was awesome.
But
that's great. That just fits with what I imagine Matt Stairs is like.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Matt's a legend, dude.
But unfortunately, none of those BP homers counted.
They don't count, dude. They don't. They definitely don't.
So,
damn it.
But you knew. You so credit to you.
So all right, weird.
Two more. Come on. Here we go. What do you remember about playing the outfield? You have done it a couple times in your career. One of them was more obvious than the other in terms of why you needed to, relatively.
Yeah.
I can't figure out why you did it later in your career, but tell me about your outfield experience as a lifetime first baseman.
Oh, I'll roll through this real quick. So the second time was we were in Yankee Stadium getting blown out. And I think to get like Salvador off his feet behind the plate, you take the DH out. So then Billy Butler, I think, went to first. I went out there. Mm-hmm. The next time, Billy Butler, 2012, he was our guy for Interleague. That was the DH. So he then went to first. Mm-hmm. And Ned Yost, literally like 2 days before we go to Pittsburgh, he's like, my nickname was Popo. He's like, hey, Popo, you ever play outfield? And I'm like, nope. And he's like, okay, well, we got a game in Thursday in Pittsburgh. You're in right field. I'm like, holy shit. So I go out there for 2 days with Rusty, our outfield coach. Disaster. Bases loaded in Pittsburgh. I think it's 0-1 outs, whatever it is. Pop or fly ball to me. I just start turning around, running towards the wall. Then I kind of look at it and I'm like, all right, this ball's way in. So I got to run way in. The ball bounces once in front of me. I get it on a bounce. Bases loaded. So I throw it to home. Would have got the force out at home. Dude, it's a perfect one-hop throw. And the catcher missed it. So then the guy scored. So I don't know. I'm pretty sure. I don't know if they gave me an error or force out or whatnot. But it was a disaster.
You know what's so funny? That screw-up is very Cespedes-esque. Where you like bungle it in the outfield and then like uncork a laser beam. That laser. Is like, that's his trademark move. Dude. But that is so funny because obviously when you think about Interleague, you think, well, oh wow, you have these, I'm sure your American League pitchers were like, Jesus, we got a hit. But you're like, oh my God, I got to play right field. This is a nightmare.
Disaster.
Whose glove did you use?
Dude, that's a great question, man. Because you obviously want to use one that's broken in. So, like, Rawlings sent me one, but I wasn't ready. It had to have been, like, one of the pitchers. Like, the pitchers call their gloves.
Like, the shagging gloves.
Yeah, it was a shagging wagon. So, I used someone's. I forget who it was.
That's great.
Dude.
I love that, too, because, hey, first step is always back. So, you have that.
Yeah. Like, fundamentals.
I can't say that. I think it's better than – I think what happened to you is better than – first step in and over your head. So.
Oh, dude. Ball hit. I was like, gone. And then I'm like, nope, that's not gone. I just started sprinting in.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to going and finding this video as soon as we are
that
done.
That video exists.
But let's finish off with one final question. Haas, we're going to give you 30 seconds to name as many of the pitchers that hit you with a pitch as possible.
Oh man.
Okay. This is called 30 seconds of plunks. Okay.
So,
dude, I'm gonna start most of these.
I'm gonna start a timer, and you can go ahead and name as many pitchers that plunked you starting now.
Damn, dude! I know Berrios got me in the World Baseball Classic, so I don't know if that one's
okay. Wow. We'll count okay, I don't have that listed.
He got
but that's
me
a great
right
one.
Here, and I started the season with just a monster welt right there. Let's see, Lester. He broke my wrist in Boston.
Correct.
Shit, man, I'm very, very bad at this one. Okay. Let's go some. Stay in the division, bro. This might
Eric
be the
Hosmer.
Only one I get.
Eric Hosmer doesn't feel pain.
I don't feel pain, dude. You can't hurt steel.
I'll give you another 30. It's okay. We'll get
maybe
you a couple more.
Gibson, did he get me at all? He's the guy I faced a lot.
Gibson, no. No, Gibson,
no, not
once.
Gibson.
Not,
Jesus.
Faced him a lot.
Freeland, Kyle Freeland broke my finger in 20, but I was doing a bunt attempt, so maybe I deserved it.
Oh, if in that case, I'm not even sure it counted because
what do
I'm
you
not,
mean?
I that might
oh,
have been
you know
a foul.
What? Dude, they struck me out. Yeah, they struck me out. And it didn't. Yeah, that's a great
Doesn't
call.
Count. Doesn't
that's
count.
Another good one. How many ejections I have. But, dude, this
oh,
hit my pitch
that's,
one. I'm bad
yeah, okay.
One.
We'll save that for the next episode. All right. We'll put you out of your misery.
Failed.
Here. I will say, the last question I'll say on this, you were hit 23 times in Major League Baseball.
Holy shit.
Only one pitcher hit you twice.
Who was it?
Jake McGee.
Jake McGee, huh?
Jake McGee wow. Hit you in 2012 and in 2021. 9 years apart, Jake McGee.
Come on, Jake. Found that guy.
Yeah, but hey, you know, Verlander.
We got a
mutual
friend, Wade Davis.
Oh, there you go. That makes sense. Yeah. But, you know, we got Verlander on here. We got Scherzer. You face those guys enough. So, but anyway, yeah. All right. Well, you remembered Berrios. You remember John Lester. That was correct.
Because
you remembered
the
a strikeout.
You remember the pain.
Yes, yeah. That is a great way to put it. That's not surprising because it's like you're only going to remember it if it actively changes your season, which if you miss time, that makes a lot of sense.
You got hit by Trevor Williams, which is like getting a massage because he throws 88.
Hey, he's still doing it, though. Find a way to get
sure is. He sure is. Eric Hosmer, this was a delight. Thank you so much for joining us on this journey. I hope you enjoyed some of it. We'll have to come up with some more questions and we'll do it again sometime, right?
Loved it, boys. Good stuff, fellas.
Haas, genuinely from the bottom of my heart, I have very much appreciated your pivot to the media side.
Appreciate it, man.
Keep it going. You have a heart for it, you give a crap, and you make good stuff. And that's all we ask for.
Love that, man. I appreciate it. Love it. Lighthearted like you guys, man.
Hey, it's not that complicated. We just want the people talking about baseball to like baseball.
Yeah, we got to make baseball. We got to make baseball cool again, huh? We got to make a way to get it back.
We're doing our thing. We're doing it.
It's back. Yeah. It's coming. I'm telling you.
Eric Hosmer, thank you, sir.
All right, fellas. Take care, man.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. Breaking news on our show. Really, for the first time, Eric Hosmer not embarking upon a comeback. You heard it here first.
He seems pretty comfortable in the podcasting chair, just like us. So, welcome, Haas. Hopefully, you guys enjoyed that conversation. We certainly did. Before we get out of here, a couple moves we wanted to talk about. Let's go around the league.
Respectfully, I'm going to override you and I'm going to say this is turbo mode because
Sorry to Connor Joe's family. This is not going to take very long.
Let's start there. The San Diego Padres had some clarity for their ownership situation with John Seidler being voted in as the official, you know, trigger man by the other 29 MLB owners at the owners' meetings at the end of last week. We did a whole segment a couple of weeks ago about the kerfuffle, discord, brouhaha, legal tete-a-tete between the Seidler brothers and the widow of Peter Seidler, who was the former owner, Sheil Seidler. There seems to be something of a resolution here with John Seidler taking the big chair because right afterwards, the Padres signed three people I guess, equaling the total that they had signed the entire winter before.
I mean, two major league deals for Connor Joe and Jason Hayward. And I had talked about it last week when we talked about position battles. Is like, are they really going to roll with Tirso or Nellis in left field? And what's their DH plan? They had to bring in some veterans. Again, these are very low cost signings. This is not, they clearly we're not going to be able to afford Jurickson Profar. So here they are with a Connor Joe, San Diego native. Very cool. We love that. Jason Hayward, his fascinating career extends further as he goes to the Padres. And then Gavin Sheets, I mean, that's more of a buy low guy who obviously never really lived up to any sort of hype from being a top pick with the White Sox, but he is maybe a DH type that could help them. So this tells me that the Padres do not have a lot of money to spend, even if they are now allowed to spend some of it. And I think that the only big move they have left is if AJ Preller kind of gets a little antsy and makes a huge trade. Otherwise, I don't really see much else happening with the Padres at this point.
The Los Angeles Angels sign Yoan Moncada to a one-year, $5 million deal. One of my favorite contracts of the offseason, and I'm going to tell you why. This appears to be the Angels accepting reality that Anthony Rendon is not going to play too many baseball games anymore. Yoan Moncada, if I had, not that he's the epitome of durability either. However, that they gave a third baseman $5 million is clearly a sign that they are like, you know what? Maybe thinking that Anthony Rendon is still an MVP candidate is not the best way to build our baseball club. And for an organization that seems to have been living in the transactional dark for a while now, I like this. This is, you know, they're not going to make the playoffs now, but it just is nice to see the Angels live in the real world sometimes.
Anthony Rendon has played 100 games over the last 2 years. Yoan Moncada has played 104 games over the last 2 years.
See?
Anthony Rendon,
that proves my point.
Anthony Rendon is owed almost $80 million over the next two seasons. And I don't know what else to say about that other than that is stinky. They also have Tim Anderson and Yolmer Sanchez. I hope they sign Jose Abreu and whatever other members of the 2018 White Sox that you would like.
Where's Rick Renteria?
Yes, two more quick moves. We got Kike back to the Dodgers. No surprise here, except that, like, there's really a spot for him, but they'll make a spot for him. And Andy Pages might be slugging in Oklahoma City all season because of it, because now there isn't really room on the bench for him if they're going to keep him and Rojas and Chris Taylor, who's still making a bunch of money.
Okay. That's the thing.
Maybe here. Chris Taylor's gone. That's maybe the thing. Possible. Yeah.
The Dodgers' decision to extend Chris Taylor, I guess, was a re-signing, yeah, has just made this so much more complicated. Like, they should have just done that with Kike at the time. Like, they picked the wrong guy. And I understand that, yeah, okay, they're a year apart. Kike's a year younger. Their production at this point is,
it's comparable. Yeah.
It's comparable.
Sure.
But the what the guy means to the fan base meter could not be more different. Like,
yeah, by this point, yeah. I mean, Chris Taylor had his moments for sure. But since he signed that deal,
with all due respect to Chris Taylor, Kike is like, there are murals of Kike in Los Angeles. No, could you imagine a Chris Taylor mural?
Chris Taylor is not. Yes, that's true. Kike has only gotten more popular, and Taylor is just like, all right, waiting for his time to kind of run out there. But he found his way back to the Dodgers, and there is no surprise there. One more deal. Trey Mancini is back. Hopefully, maybe. Trey Mancini, of course, one of our favorite humans in the game, of course, had his battle with cancer that took him away from the game for a little bit. He made it back to playing, which was pretty astonishing, but obviously he has not been quite the same player since that. He did not play in 2024, but now he signs a minor league deal with the Diamondbacks, who I know they just signed Randall Grichuk, but there's still maybe some DH at bats here, or DH first base at bats there. I know they got Josh Naylor. There's maybe a path to the roster here for Mancini, but obviously a guy who hasn't played in a year, you never really know what to see, but it's just nice to see that he's not done playing yet, because that's a guy we like to run into. So,
legitimately good man. Like, awesome, awesome dude.
Yeah.
Happy for Trey that he's given it one last go. All right, Jordan. over the weekend, you had homework. Your homework was to essentially create Patrick Mahomes' baseball career. If he had never picked up a football, what would have been his path through the hardball lifestyle? Mm-hmm. So I asked you to write, I believe, a paragraph or two detailing his career, giving me some of his numbers. Did you do your homework?
Not how you described it, but I did do a lot on Patrick Mahomes, the baseball player. Jake, I'm going to let this be a choose your own adventure because I'm going to let you decide which path I take here. Because I think when people hear Patrick Mahomes baseball, they think, oh, his dad was a big league pitcher. He would obviously also be a big league pitcher. However, when Patrick Mahomes was drafted out of high school by the Detroit Tigers in 2014, he was announced as an outfielder. Huh. Interviews with the scout that signed him, this is from a Jason Beck article, 2020. Tim Grieve, the Tigers scout who saw him and decided to draft him in the 37th round, he said he's got the, you know, he's talking about, oh, amazing tools, blah, blah, blah. He might have ended up being a center fielder, hitting third in your lineup. I'm not even sure pitching was the best thing he did. So my question to you, Jake, is would you rather take the path where he is a position player or a reliever? Because I will only do one of those.
A position player.
Good. Good pick. Thank you. Patrick Mahomes, for some reason, at some point during his senior year of high school, decides this football thing, I'm bored, or I'm scared of what this will do to my brain in the future. I am going to sign with the Detroit Tigers. Stunning. 37th round. Texas Tech is furious. They're like,
fuming.
What is our plan at quarterback? We had Mahomes coming in, and he suddenly decided to sign with the Tigers.
Cliff Kingsbury in shambles.
Yes, I think. I don't know who was his head coach at the time. Anyway, whatever. The point is, the Tigers, they get him signed. They announce him as an outfielder. They sent him out as an outfielder. And the timing here is important because Patrick Mahomes at this point joins a Tigers farm system that is by far the worst in baseball. Okay, this is, again, you go back and look, this is like after the Tigers were really good for a long time, Dombrowski and everything that they handled, this was a desolate minor league organization. And this works in Patrick Mahomes' favor because there's really not a lot of other talent in the organization. He joins Derek Hill, who was the other top pick from their draft. And that was their first rounder that year. And they kind of form this bond, this Derek Hill, Patrick Mahomes outfield duo. This is kind of like the Julio and Kelnick dynamic that we had
a couple
years ago. Well, exactly. So they're climbing the minors together. They're in West Michigan. They're in Erie. Both of the guys, you know, Derek Hill's a little bit more defensive minded. You have Patrick Mahomes is kind of developing into more of this corner bat. It's taking him some time though. I mean, it's a couple years in low A with like a 650 OPS, but then
he's putting on more mass than you'd expect.
Yeah,
he's given his frame.
He's maintaining some athleticism, but he's leaning into more of the power profile.
Yeah.
All right. But the hit tool's taken a while to really come together. Right. So he's got the arm. Now we're looking like kind of a prototypical right field profile, but he kind of starts stalling out in Erie. All right. We're doing a couple of years with the Seawolves and it's like, oh man. And then the whispers are starting, Jake. The whispers are starting. What are they saying?
Is he going to go play college football?
Yeah, well, they're saying, well, he shouldn't be hitting. Like, either you got to get back on the mound, or you got to go. You got to go see if you could, you know, go play quarterback. You got to pull a Brandon Whedon. But he sticks it. I says, no. I'm going to see this through. I believe in myself. And inspired by Bubba Starling, who is dealing with very similar things at the exact same time, he pushes through and manages to make it to the major leagues. He wills his way with athleticism and likability. Patrick Mahomes wills his way to a fourth outfielder lifestyle. He is somewhere on the spectrum of like Tyrone Taylor to like off the offensive line is kind of looking like a Brian De La Cruz is kind of the slash line that we're looking at, but like the competent version, not the one that the Pirates non-tendered. Like he's useful and he's given you a couple just mind-blowing throws from right field every couple months that makes you think, oh, I don't know. Like, is this really what he should have been doing? And then he just does that. He's just a very normal fourth outfielder. Occasionally, you know, he has like a Randall Grichuk type season where he destroys lefties and everyone's like, whoa, Patrick Mahomes, a better hitter than we thought. He always had the tools to be an impact player. But for the most part, he's just kind of an unremarkable third and a half outfielder for about 6 or 7 years. And then everyone just says, what if?
Would have been, you know, perfectly nice career.
Yeah, and he would have avoided the embarrassment of last night. So
true.
Did he make the right decision? I'm not so sure.
Who could say? We got a great email, by the way, from someone who saw Patrick Mahomes pitch at Texas Tech. Did you read that?
Yes. I mean, I had a lot of stuff on Patrick Mahomes pitching, but I enjoyed the position player one. He pitched one time in college. He did not record an out. It went walk, hit by pitch, walk.
Been there.
Jake knows something about that kind of appearance. So, you know, maybe he would have figured it out on the mound if he focused on that and went to Texas Tech as a pitcher only. But I don't know. I kind of like the one where he just becomes a normal, normal, forgettable outfielder. I think that's funny.
Incredible. Thank you, anyway, Jordan. Good homework.
Thank you. I will give you homework later this week. But with that, we are done. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz for making this show possible. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. I am flying to Arizona on Wednesday, so I will talk to you from the desert on Thursday. But until then, enjoy pitchers and catchers showing up at 6 a.m. with their cups of coffee and ready to play catch.
I need that pitchers and catchers report on my desk first thing Tuesday morning.
We'll talk to you later this week. Bye-bye.